in people listening to radios through headsets. They had sheets of copy paper beside them, which they were filling with tiny, neatly handwritten notes. We stopped at a door at the back of the room of cubicles. Earl knocked once and, without waiting for an answer, opened the door to usher me through. We interrupted a discussion so heated it seemed likely to ignite. A tiny elderly woman with a huge flare of crazed white hair stood with her back to us. She was gesturing forcefully at a much taller, regal-looking woman, her steel and salt hair tied up in a bun.
"Have to supply more lamp oil, Kenda," the shorter woman said.
"We don't have any to spare," the taller woman said.
"Then at least cut some more windows in the walls."
"I already told you, Rita May, all the window glass is allocated to build cold frames. You'll just have to read your precious books outside. It's not good for the..."
Earl cleared his throat. "Excuse me." Rita May spun and glared at Earl. Then her gaze skipped to me. I recognized her. She was the librarian who'd helped me and Darla last year.
"You," she said, leveling a finger at me. "I've met you. Alex, right?"
"Yeah, Alex Halperin," I said. "How'd you remember?"
"I never forget a patron, or their questions. You asked about rabbit diseases."
"I found him on the road," Earl said, addressing Kenda. "Or he found us. Couple of bandit trucks took a pot shot at us as we were getting set up to dig corn. We chased them, but they were trying to lure us into an ambush. He," Earl nodded my direction, "saved us."
"Hmm," Kenda said. "Guess we owe him, then."
"Owe him a place in town, you ask me," Earl replied. "Would have lost a lot of men without his warning."
"Why not?" Kenda frowned. Then her words turned bitter. "What's one more soul to starve to death with the rest of us?"
"I'm not staying," I said. "I need help to rescue Darla."
"I was about to ask if she was with you," Rita May said.
She fell, got shot, I mean, then fell on the roof of a truck."
I bit the inside of my cheek hard enough to taste blood.
Rita May looked away. "She fell on one of the bandits' trucks," Earl said. "If the bullet didn't kill her, they probably have."
I turned to glare at Earl, fists balled. He held out his hands in a gesture meant to be placating and said,
"I'm sorry to keep offending you, son, but it's nothing but the unvarnished truth."
"Much as we'd all like to," Kenda said, "we can't spare anyone to go chasing after Darla. But we're having a hard enough time keeping everyone safe and fed without risking a rescue mission for a girl who might already be dead."
"Darla is not dead!"
I let my voice get louder than I'd intended. "But I was sick and tired of everyone assuming she was dead. They couldn't know that. They were just guessing. She was alive. She had to be."
Kenda stared at me. The turn of her mouth and droop of her eyes made her look tired.
"I'm sorry."
I swayed, sidestepping to stay on my feet.
"Maybe the mayor will have a different opinion. Can't I at least ask him?"
Kenda's frown turned to a scowl, and her eyes narrowed.
"You just did."
"Oh, you're... sorry, I mean... sorry, Mrs. Mayor. I mean, Madam Mayor?
Just Kenda will be fine."
I jammed my hand into my pocket and ran my fingers over the broken necklace I'd stowed there.
"Please help," I whispered. "I know Darla's alive. We can save her. Please."
"I'm sorry," Kenda said, her own voice low. "We're barely digging enough corn to fend off starvation. I need everyone we have to defend the town and the corn-digging expeditions. We can't afford to risk anyone in a rescue attempt." My legs felt weak. I fell, my butt thumping onto the hard floor. Something trickled along my cheeks.
"You need anything else from me, Kenda?"
"No, Earl, thank you."
"I'll go see about putting another corn-digging expedition on the road, then." Earl left the office. Kenda knelt and laid her hand on my arm.
"I wish we could help, but it's impossible, no matter how much you love her. I couldn't send a rescue mission after my own daughter." I can pay, I said through my tears. 17 packets of kale seeds, 3,400 good seeds. Grows even in cold greenhouses, and it cures scurvy. I reached into my jacket pocket and pulled out the pouch holding the seed envelopes. Kenda looked at Rita Mae. Would that work? Is kale better than dandelion greens? Let me check. Rita Mae left the office. Dandelion greens, I said. Yes, Kenda replied. When the first cases of scurvy hit, we built greenhouses and planted every kind of seed we could lay our hands on. Nothing survived but weeds. So now we cultivate dandelions. They're the only source of vitamin C we have. I didn't even know you could eat those. Sure, they don't taste bad. Bitter sometimes if you don't pick the leaves young enough. Where do you grow them? Cold frames on the roof of the school. A cold frame is sort of a really small greenhouse. We heat ours using power we're generating with old windmills. And grow dandelions. Yes, but if kale has a higher vitamin C content than dandelion, those seeds could be a huge help. Rita Mae walked back into the room, carrying a fat, well-used paperback, the Nutribase Nutrition Facts Desk Reference. She was flipping through it as she walked. Kale, kale. Here. Well, break my bindings. 80.4 milligrams per cup. That's. She flipped through the book. More than 4 times as much vitamin C as dandelion greens. Probably tastes better, too. So you'll do it? I said, holding out the pouch toward Kenda. You'll help me save Darla? I can't. I wish I could. But we need your kale seeds, so I can give you a place in Worthington. A house if you want it, any supplies you need. I'd do more if I could. But we just can't risk any of our people. What do I need with a house? Or a place in Worthington? I hurled the pouch across the room. It thumped against the wall and fell intact to the floor. Not that I cared if it had burst and spread kale seeds everywhere. If the seeds couldn't buy Darla's return, then they were worthless to me. Are you crazy? Rita Mae grabbed the bundle of envelopes off the floor. We need those seeds, Kenda said. I need help going after Darla. It's impossible. Then sell me a snowmobile, guns, and supplies. We don't have any working snowmobiles, and I can't let you leave. You can't let me... What? Rita Mae said. We're not letting most refugees stay, and you're telling this young man that he can't leave? He's just a boy, Kenda said. That doesn't make it right to hold him against his will, Rita Mae replied. He'll get killed wandering around out there on his own. That's his choice to make. I'm going after Darla. Unless you throw me in jail, I'm leaving now. We don't even have a jail, Rita Mae said, and you need supplies. And you need my kale seeds. Sell me one of those pickups and some gas. We've only got 2 that work, Kenda said. We can't spare one. Or any gas. We're running out. You won't help me go after Darla, don't have any snowmobiles, won't sell me a truck. Why shouldn't I take my kale seeds and leave? Kenda started, because you'll get killed out. Because we need them, Rita Mae interrupted. And you need supplies, guns, ammo, food. I can't just let him wander out. You can't stop him. Rita Mae turned to me. Here's what you need. A blanket requisition for personal items. I'm not giving him carte blanche to take anything, Kenda yelled, exasperation plain in her voice. It's a fair deal, Rita Mae said. Just what supplies he can carry, plus 10 gallons of lamp oil for my library. Mayor Kenda shot Rita Mae a look sour enough to spoil milk. I'll need guns, I said. A rifle and a pistol, at least. A blanket requisition from the mayor will let you pick out whatever you need from the town stores. Fine, I said, staring down the mayor until she broke the standoff, averting her eyes. Fine, Mayor Kenda said. A blanket requisition for personal items in return for all your kale seeds. And a lamp oil for the library, in return for 1,000 kale seeds, 5 packets. I didn't need the lamp oil, but I figured insisting on it would piss off Mayor Kenda, and she deserved it for threatening to keep me from leaving. It was the least I could do to repay Rita Mae for her support.
5 packets? You offered 17 packets not 10 minutes ago.
Sure, for mounting a rescue, I said. That deal's still on the table.
I can't.
Kenda pulled at her ear. Then you only get 5 packets. I took the bundle from Rita Mae, counted out 5 envelopes, and held them out to Mayor Kenda. Take it or leave it. Darla doesn't have time for me to waste arguing.
Mayor Kenda took the packets. She scrawled something on a scrap of paper from her desk and signed it. When she held the paper toward me, Rita Mae grabbed it.
My lamp oil, Rita Mae said. She handed the paper back to Kenda. Kenda wrote something else on the paper and thrust it at Rita Mae.
Satisfied?
Yep, I'll see that he gets everything he wants. Rita Mae ushered me out of the office. As we left, she gestured at the bloody cloth tied around my right arm.
Should check on your wound.
I guess. Earl said it needed stitches.
We'd best visit the fire station then. Paramedic there, Floyd, has a better hand for stitching up flesh than I do.
Floyd did prove to have a deft hand with his needle. He worked fast, too, which was a blessing. Getting stitched up without anesthetic isn't much fun. The needle itself wasn't all that bad, but the pressure it put on the gouge in my flesh sent flashes of pain up and down my arm and even into my teeth.
While Floyd worked on my arm, I tried to distract myself by thinking about the supplies I'd need. Skis, guns, a tent, a pack, the list seemed endless.
Can you write a supply list for me? I asked Rita Mae.
Paper's dear. Just tell me. We'll remember it.
Okay. Ow!
Sorry, Floyd said. Almost done. Maybe just 2 more stitches will do it.
Rita Mae and I talked through the supply list while Floyd finished up. He got the wound closed with just 4 stitches, one for the entrance wound at the back of my arm and 3 for the exit wound at the front. Then Rita Mae led me around the town. Starting from the fire station, we went back to City Hall and then to the small downtown business district. The piece of paper signed by Mayor Kenda magically produced whatever we asked for. At our last stop, St. Paul's School, we picked up 2 5-gallon gasoline cans full of lamp oil. Mrs. Nance, the principal, was none too happy about giving it up. We were taking more than half her supply. But when she complained, Rita Mae shook the paper with the mayor's signature under her nose. By the time we finished our tour of Worthington, I was equipped better than Darla and I had been when we left Warren on Bikezilla. I had a big internal frame Kelty backpack, a set of Salomon XADV backcountry skis, boots and poles, a big Agnes tent, an REI down sleeping bag, a plastic tarp, a coil of nylon rope, a working butane lighter, an amazing luxury compared to a flint and steel or the fire by friction set, 3 candles, a set of aluminum pans, a small first aid kit, a needle and thread, enough cornmeal, dried meat, and dandelion greens to last for weeks, 2 changes of insulated winter clothes, a Bushmaster 308 hunting rifle, similar to Uncle Paul's, a Browning high-power pistol I had no idea how to use, and a box of extra ammo for each of the guns. The weight of the backpack on my hips and shoulders amazed me. A handful of minuscule seeds had turned into this? It wasn't too different from before the volcano, when wealth could be carried on a tiny plastic card. But the best part about the supplies, the only part that mattered, maybe they'd give me the chance to reach Darla.
Chapter 31. As we trudged away from the school, I heard a burst of far-off gunfire. I dropped both cans of oil, ducked, and swiveled. All I could see was the backside of the town wall. I looked at Rita Mae. She hadn't even flinched.
"Who's shooting?" I asked.
"Blasted bandits taking pot shots at someone," Rita Mae replied.
"Happens almost every day. They never hit anyone. They're just reminding us that they're still out there, waiting."
"Waiting for what?"
"Waiting for us to let down our guard, maybe. Waiting for a chance to get inside the city walls. Waiting to butcher us all, no doubt.
And FEMA does nothing." I heard another shot from closer by. Looking toward the wall, I pinpointed the source of the sound, a guy I hadn't seen before on his belly atop the wall, returning fire with a rifle. Worse than nothing. Jumped up peacock that runs that camp in Makokata came up here and offered to protect us. All we had to do was abandon Worthington and move into his camp. Mayor Kenda said anyone who wanted to leave with him could. No one left. Four guys carrying rifles ran past us on their way to the wall. Should we do anything? I asked. I'm certainly not going to go climbing up the steps in that ice wall. Now, if the bandits made it to the door of my library, that'd be a different matter. Then they'd have me and a 20-gauge deer slug to deal with. You do what you think best, son. Do you think the guys on the wall need help? Doesn't sound like much of a firefight. The shooting died down to an occasional pop. I picked up the gas cans and trudged alongside the road beside Rita May. The weight of the can tugged at the stitches in my right arm. I bit my lip and ignored the pain. The least I could do in return for Rita May's help was carry the oil to her library. The roads had all been bulldozed clear, although icy patches of packed snow and frozen ash clung to them here and there. I had to move slowly and watch my step. You were smart not to let FEMA put you in a camp. Darla and I got locked into a camp outside Galena for a couple weeks last year. It was hell. The colonel who runs the Makokata FEMA camp came back a few weeks after his first visit. Had a bunch more men with him. Said we had to relocate to the camp for protection, whether we wanted to or not. What'd you do? Showed him the business end of our rifles. The people still here who've survived, they're tough. Rather be killed than locked up in some camp or made slaves, I reckon. Yeah, me too. So how did you and Darla wind up in a FEMA camp? Rita May asked. We were trying to get to my uncle's farm near Warren, Illinois. You got picked up by FEMA on your way there? Yeah. So what happened? Tell me about your trip. I didn't want to talk about it. The trip itself had been bad enough. We had encountered humanity at its sublime best and its savage worst. I would excise parts of that trip from my mind forever if I could. But the worst part was thinking about Darla. That she might be... I didn't even want to think the word. I wanted to curl up in the icy road and cry until my tears froze me to the pavement. But that wouldn't help Darla. And she was alive. She had to be alive. Are you all right? Rita May asked. You look like you just heard your best friend died. Darla, I choked on her name. Oh, of course. I shouldn't have brought it up. Forgive me. I put down the gas cans and adjusted my grip. You don't have to talk about it. No, it's okay. And for some reason, it was. I told her about our trip. About how Darla had saved my life, first in the icy stream and again at the FEMA camp. I told Rita May about our life at Uncle Paul's farm, how we'd managed to survive so far, about our plans to build more greenhouses, to raise wheat and outlast the volcanic winter. By the time I finished, we were at the library. Rita May unlocked the door and showed me where to stow the cans of lamp oil. "What I don't understand," she said, "is why you came back. Why didn't you stay in Warren? Sounds like you had a decent chance of surviving." "We were looking for my parents. A bandit gang attacked my uncle's farm. We beat them off, killed two. One of them was carrying my dad's shotgun. Darla and I tracked down another member of the gang and found out that the shotgun probably came from the Makokata FEMA camp." I lapsed into silence for a moment. The enormity of what I've done, dragging Darla back into this mess, fell over me like smoke, choking me. Rita May broke the silence. I'm too stupid to live. I should never have dragged Darla back out here, not for anything. Bad things are happening everywhere. You weren't safe on your uncle's farm, either. You just said a bandit gang attacked it. Darla could have gotten hurt anywhere, anytime. Yes, but what I was trying to say is that maybe I can help, at least where your parents are concerned. How? What do you mean, help? Just because a supervolcano erupts, it doesn't mean the library's business stops. I'm still developing my collection, like those modern librarians say. What does that have to do with my parents? I'm getting to that. Keep your horses reined. Ever since FEMA opened a camp in Maquoketa, Kenda and I have been trying to get a copy of their roster. Folks want to know if their missing friends and relatives are locked up in there. You got one? A roster?
Yep. Rita May pulled a huge stack of worn and dog-eared copy paper off the bookcase behind her desk. We bought it off a gleaner, Grant Clark, 2 months ago.
A gleaner?
Yep. Gleaners are groups of people who roam around scavenging and trading. At least they used to be. We haven't seen any of them in 5 or 6 weeks. Gangs might have gotten them all.
How do you know it's real?
We don't, not for certain. But Grant said he got it from a guard at the Maquoketa camp. And he's always been reliable before.
My hands shook. A memory flashed through my head. Mom scolding me for leaving my bike in the middle of the garage. Dad's distracted half-smile as he listened. I'd mostly tuned Mom out then. But now I desperately wanted to hear her again, regardless of how much we had fought. My brain was alight with hope. I felt dizzy and realized I'd forgotten to breathe. After 10 months of searching for them, news of my mother and father might be only an arm's length away.
Chapter 32. Rita May was already flipping through the papers. Goodwin, Haley, Halperin, Doug?
Dad, I whispered.
Janice?
Mom.
I planted my hands on the table, holding myself up.
I had to remind myself to breathe again. They were alive.
They were alive 2 months ago, anyway.
And they're in Maquoketa.
They were when this list was printed. That's all we can say for certain.
I collapsed onto a bench, my backpack jammed against the wall behind me. I scooted forward and put my head between my knees, trying to think. My parents might be alive and close by. Darla might be dead. Dad, Darla, Mom, Darla. I couldn't think, couldn't focus. I had to try to rescue my parents. I had to go after Darla. And I had no idea how to accomplish either of those things. A shiver passed down my spine, making me sway involuntarily.
I felt an arm across my shoulders. Rita May had sat down beside me on the bench and pulled me toward her. I flopped right over, my head cradled in her lap. She smelled of book dust and mildew, not entirely pleasant, but somehow comforting.
"I can't do this," I moaned. "I can't handle it. Everything's gone to ash. I don't know how to make it right again."
"None of us can handle it, sweetie. We just do the best we can." Rita May gently stroked my hair.
"Earl says Darla's dead. She can't be dead. Earl's gotta be wrong."
I rubbed my fists against my eyes.
"What do you think?"
"Are you asking me for reassurance or for the truth, Alex?" I thought for a moment. My mother used to say never ask for the truth unless you were prepared to handle it. I swallowed hard and said, "The truth. She's probably dead. Either the bullet killed her or the Peckerwoods did." I choked back a sob.
"If she is alive, that might be worse," Rita May said.
"What do you mean? Grant told us the gangs are trading in slaves, young girls mostly. So Darla could be alive. Not a life such as I'd want to live, a slave to bandits and rapists. But..." I pushed myself out of Rita May's lap. "I'm going after her.
Your parents have been in that camp for months and have each other. They can wait. Darla can't. I'm leaving now.
There can't be much more than 4 or 5 hours of light left in the day. Won't do her any good if you get killed. Best you go at first light, rested and with a full stomach." Every muscle in my body was tensed, as if screaming at me to get moving. Now! But Rita May was right. I was sleepwalking through the day in a fugue state, dead to the world, dead even to my body's needs. At least I could force down some food before I left. I breathed in. "Okay," I muttered. Rita May closed up the library and took me to her home. It looked different than it had the year before. Back then, the front porch had been a collapsed wreck. Someone had cleaned up the mess, removing the jumble of joists, rafters, and shingles. They hadn't rebuilt the porch, though. Long scars marked where it had been attached to the house. The front door was about 3 feet off the ground. I saw a new structure behind the house, a small outhouse built of unpainted gray boards. "We'll go around back," Rita Mae said. "The first step's not such a doozy." Rita Mae fed me a huge meal, a dandelion green salad drizzled with a bit of soybean oil, then a hasty pudding. Her version turned out to be cornmeal mush flavored with dandelion flowers and tiny bits of beef. It tasted a little odd, but it was filling, so I ate 3 servings. She did all the cooking at the hearth in the living room, over a small fire she fed with scraps of 2x4. My offer to help was met with a dismissive wave. For dessert, she fried a hamburger only a little bigger than a quarter. "Where'd you get the meat?" I asked. "Some of our cows survived the ashfall. We slaughtered almost all of them not long after winter set in. We ran out of hay, and we can't afford to feed them on corn. That's most of my meat ration for the week." "Here." I pushed my plate toward her. "You eat it." "Now, what kind of hostess would that make me?"
"An alive one?" I shrugged and cut the burger in half with the edge of my fork.
"Halvesies, or I'm not eating it either." "Okay." Rita Mae speared her half of the hamburger with her fork and lifted it to her mouth. The beef was delicious, hot and crispy and juicy. When we finished cleaning up from our huge late lunch, I picked up my backpack and struggled to force my aching right arm through the straps.
"You leaving already?" Rita Mae asked. I nodded.
"Won't make it to Cascade before dark." I shrugged. "Going to stick out like a sore thumb with that bright blue backpack." I thought about it for a moment. The insulated coveralls Rita Mae had helped me procure were light brown. Not too bad. But the backpack would be painfully obvious against the snow.
"I guess you're right. I need some kind of camouflage," I told Rita Mae. "Something that won't stand out against the snow."
"A ghillie suit," Rita Mae said.
"A what?"
"It's a suit with lots of strips of cloth hanging off of it, made to blend in with the underbrush. Snipers use them. I read about them in Rainbow Six by Tom Clancy. Good book."
"Can we trade for one?"
"They're usually made in brown and green camouflage. What we want is a white and gray version to blend in with the snow."
"Yeah, that'd be perfect." I put down my backpack.
"I'll see if we can't make something that'll work." Rita Mae dug through some cabinets, coming back with 2 old white bedsheets, a fat black Sharpie, and her sewing kit. We spent the rest of the evening tearing strips from the bedsheets, streaking them with the marker, and sewing them onto my coveralls, backpack, and ski mask. I tried on everything when we were done, posing in front of a full-length mirror in Rita Mae's bedroom. I looked completely ridiculous, like a survivor of an explosion at a sheet-making factory. Still, the strips of fabric hid most of the bright colors of my clothing and pack. It wasn't like I was a contestant in some post-apocalyptic fashion show. It'd do. By the time we finished, we were working by lamplight. I still wanted to leave, but I knew Rita Mae was right about waiting for daylight. I might get lost wandering around in a dark, post-volcanic night and never get close to wherever Darla was. We put away the sewing supplies and started dinner. I tore up dandelion leaves for a salad while Rita Mae fried corn pone pancakes in soybean oil. The aroma of cooking brought my hunger back powerfully despite the huge lunch I'd eaten. I ate everything, fueling my body for the coming fight. After dinner, Rita Mae made up a bed for me in the living room near the fire and said goodnight. I lay awake for a while, knowing I needed to sleep, but unable to shut off my mind, unable to stop thinking about Darla. When I awoke, Rita Mae was already up. The dim yellow-gray light in the eastern windows told me it wasn't much past dawn. We had leftover corn pone pancakes for breakfast. Rita Mae ate just one, but I wolfed 6 of them. I would need the energy. I double-checked my gear and finished packing.
"You sure you want to head out there?" Rita Mae asked as I worked.
"Seems like a good way to get killed."
"Yes," I said, and then hesitated. Was I answering yes, I wanted to go, or yes, it was a good way to get killed? Both, I decided. If Darla's alive, she needs me. If she's dead, I need to know. Rita Mae nodded and gently took hold of my left arm. And if I get killed, I shrugged, at least I'll have died trying to help the girl I love. Rita Mae pulled me into a hug. Guess I'll see you as far as the gate. I had to keep my pace slow to match Rita Mae's, but I didn't mind. I'd spent enough time with her last year and again over the last 24 hours that she was familiar and comfortable. I didn't even feel the need to speak as we walked toward the south gate. Walking with Rita Mae brought my mother back to mind. I couldn't remember ever just walking with Mom in comfortable silence like this. Sure, I usually hadn't said much when we were together, but Mom always kept up a steady stream of chatter, plans, information, and admonitions that I got remarkably good at tuning out. I took Rita Mae's hand and squeezed it once before letting it drop. She looked at me and smiled, maintaining the easy and precious silence between us. Perhaps I thought of my mom because it was too terrifying to think about Darla, that she might be dead or worse. Still, I had to focus. Darla first. If I survived looking for her, then I'd resume the search for my parents. We reached Worthington South Gate, the one I'd entered through the day before. Two guards sat on stools beside it, four more arrayed at the top of the nearby walls. All of them were armed with rifles. "Open up," Rita Mae called. "Crazy boy wants to leave our fine upstanding town." One of the guards stood up. "No can do, Miss Rita." Chapter 33. "What do you mean?" Rita Mae said. "Lift the bar and pull that gate open. That's what you're here for, isn't it?"
"Can't do that. Mayor says he's got to stay inside the city walls."
I strode toward the gate, figuring I'd just climb over it. One of the guards sidestepped, putting himself in my path. I butted chests with him. The top of my head barely reached his neck.
"What right do you have to keep him here? Get out of his way and open the gate this instant, Roger Thornton."
"Orders are orders," he replied. "I can open the gate and let you out, Miss Rita. Heck, with how much you fuss with the mayor, I might not be allowed to let you back in. But if he tries to leave, I've got to stop him."
"We'll just see about that," Rita Mae muttered. She yanked on my right arm, clearly forgetting about the gunshot wound. "Easy, that hurts," I hissed under my breath. "Sorry, let's go talk some sense into Kenda."
The leisurely pace Rita Mae had set in reaching the gate was now replaced with a walk so brisk I had to jog to keep up, the pack thumping rhythmically against my back. We crashed through the reception room at City Hall and barged into the mayor's office without knocking.
"What is this nonsense about imprisoning this young fellow who's done us no harm?" Rita Mae yelled. "In fact, he's done us considerable good by bringing those kale seeds."
"Rita Mae, he's just a kid," Mayor Kenda replied.
"I'm 16, I said.
"Exactly. How can I, in good conscience, let you go wandering around in that mess outside? You're going to get killed."
"How can you, in good conscience, keep him locked inside the city?" Rita Mae retorted.
"How are we any better than those FEMA goons locking people into their refugee camps if we do the same thing?"
"He's a child, Rita Mae," Kenda yelled. "Without children, we don't have any future."
"Without freedom," Rita Mae yelled back, "why would we want a future?"
"Look," I said, trying to alleviate the shouting match. "Can we..."
"Come on."
Rita Mae grabbed my arm and towed me out of the mayor's office. She slammed the door so hard the whole wall shook. She led me back to her house, muttering all the way about damn bureaucrats and interfering do-gooders.
"I've got to get out of here."
"I know. I'm making a plan."
"What?" I asked as we stepped into her living room. I hoped it was a good plan. I didn't really relish a 16-foot drop off the outside of the icy wall.
"Never mind that. Help me untie this clothesline."
A nylon rope was tied just above head height in Rita Mae's living room, zigzagging 5 or 6 times in front of the fire. Rita Mae started taking clothespins off the line while I struggled with the knots.
"You know, I have rope in my pack."
"You might need that later. Best we use mine for this." Won't the guards see us? I don't want to wait till dark.
You let me worry about that.
I shrugged and got back to work on the knots. When we finished, we had a coil of good nylon rope about 50 feet long. Rita Mae led me out of the house and to the southeast corner of town, out of sight of the south gate. The ice wall ran right through the backyard of a one-story house. A path led to a staircase carved on the inside of the wall. Not far from the staircase, a man lay atop the wall, scanning the horizon through his rifle sight. Rita Mae pushed through the deep snow near the base of the staircase, whispering,
"It was here somewhere. I know it was."
After a minute or two of that, she gestured for me to join her and started digging in the snow. I helped her uncover a hidden tree stump. Rita Mae tied one end of her rope around the stump and tugged hard on it, making sure it was secure.
"Now, when the time is right," she whispered, "you run up those steps and use the rope to lower yourself down the far side of the ice wall. But the guard, I'll handle him. Now get your skis and poles secure in one arm so you can manage the rope in the other. And Alex?"
I paused in my preparations.
"Yeah?"
"Take care of yourself." Rita Mae pulled me into a hug. I nodded, but the lump in my throat prevented me from saying anything. I fought down sudden tears. The guard still hadn't noticed us. His attention was focused completely on the world outside the ice wall. Rita Mae released me and tiptoed up the steps. When she reached the top of the wall, she took a step toward him, and he startled, swinging toward her, his rifle at the ready.
"Rita Mae, don't go sneaking up on me like that. I could have shot you."
"You're more a danger to yourself than me with that rifle. Now, Mr. Chapman, I have important business to take up with you." Rita Mae's voice was laden with disapprobation.
"Well, then get your fool head down while you conduct whatever your business is," Chapman said. "You're liable to get shot standing up here like that."
Rita Mae stepped over Chapman and crouched on his far side, so to face her, he was forced to roll over and put his back toward the staircase. I took that as my cue. Paying out rope from one hand, I crept to the base of the ice stairs.
"Mr. Chapman, you checked out a copy of Gone 18 days ago, and as you are no doubt aware, the checkout periods for fiction have been reduced to 2 weeks for the duration of the emergency."
"Jesus, is that what you came all the way up here for? I'm on duty. Besides, I returned that book last week."
I moved up the steps as fast and quietly as I could. They were slick, and my hands were fully occupied.
"My records clearly indicate that Gone has not been returned to the collection."
"Well, your records are wrong, Rita Mae."
"Librarians never make mistakes, Mr. Chapman. Now I must insist that you..."
While they argued, I reached the top of the wall. It was at least 8 feet wide and sloped slightly back toward the town. I stood at the outer edge and stared over the brink. 16 feet doesn't sound like much, but from where I stood, it seemed like a long drop. I dropped the rest of the rope over the side. The slap of the rope hitting the ground drew Chapman's attention. He rolled back toward me.
"Hey, you, stop!"
It was now or never. I grabbed the rope, scrunched my eyes closed, and stepped off the edge. I fell sickeningly at first, but then the rope went taut and caught me with a jerk that threatened to tear my left arm out of its socket. I eased my grip on the rope and let it slide slowly through my glove. In seconds, I felt snow under my feet. When I opened my eyes and looked up, Chapman was standing atop the wall, aiming his rifle at me. Rita Mae grabbed the barrel of the rifle and pushed it upward so it was aimed at the horizon instead of my head.
"What are you thinking, aiming a rifle at that boy? We can't go shooting our friends."
Chapman sighed so heavily I could hear it at the base of the wall.
"There never was any problem with any overdue library book, was there?"
"Of course not. Although I do have the sequel for you. We can stop at the library and get it on our way to the mayor's office. You do want to turn me into Kenda for insubordination or some such, don't you?"
"Not really, but I have to."
I'd gotten snapped into my skis while they talked. Now I looked up and called.
"Thanks, Rita Mae."
"You're welcome," she replied. "You be careful, you hear?
I'd like to see you again, to know you made it."
"I'll be careful.
and I'll visit again if I can. I turned my skis south toward Cascade and pushed off, sliding away from the safety and confinement of Worthington's Wall. Chapter 34. The only way I knew to get to Cascade, where Darla had been shot, was by following Highway 136. But on skis I could stay off the roads, and traveling cross-country seemed safer. So I veered left until I could just make out the snow berm along Highway 136 and followed that south. I needn't have been so cautious. The road and surrounding countryside were deserted all morning. I reached Cascade in about 3 hours and slid between the close-set brick walls of two burnt houses to rest and have a quick lunch. After lunch, I clambered up a fallen and charred beam inside one of the houses until I could poke my head above the exterior wall and look out over the town. The blue steel water tower that marked the Peckerwoods' base was barely visible in the distance. Between me and the water tower, there was a downtown with a lot of fire-gutted brick buildings. To my left, the land fell away into a valley with a small, frozen stream well below the level of the town itself. That appeared to be the best route. The buildings and slope would shield me from anyone who might be looking. On the other hand, if anyone did get close enough to see me, I would get barely any warning. I inched carefully back down to ground level, sliding along the beam on my butt. I snapped into my skis and set out, heading toward the valley. To get there, I had to cross the highway I'd been following all morning. I stopped alongside a shell of a convenience store and looked both ways, waiting and listening for anyone who might be in a position to spot me as I crossed the open road. After 5 minutes or so, I decided it was safe and darted across. On the far side, a steep slope led down to the valley. I dropped into a tuck and whooshed silently down the hill. I skied through the valley until I'd left the downtown behind. A small, frozen creek with steep banks cut across my path. I slid down onto the ice and sidestepped laboriously up the far bank. I emerged from the gully onto a football field. The turf wasn't visible, of course, but the yellow goalpost still stood, shockingly bright against the snow. The blackened and broken windows of a low brick building looked out over the field, the local high school, I figured. Past the school, there were several large metal commercial buildings, mostly crushed by the ash and snow. Everything was quiet, dead. Finally, I reached the base of the hill that supported the water tower, where I'd seen what I figured was part of the Peckerwood gang hanging out. The huge Woody Woodpecker graffito mocked me. I ducked behind a wrecked building, hiding myself from Woody and any other observers who might be keeping watch. I worked my way slowly up the hill, moving from building to building, trying to stay under cover. Each time I left the shelter of a building, I stopped to listen for a minute or two first. I still heard nothing, but the silence felt ominous. I reached the back of one of the twin apartment buildings at the top of the hill. Attached garages jutted off the rear of the building at regular intervals. Beyond this point, I remembered, there was a large open field flanked by the huge maintenance shed where I'd seen the Peckerwoods working on their snowmobiles and cooking. If I went any farther, I'd be seen. I hid in the corner between the apartment building and one of its attached garages and tried to think through my next move. I needed to spy on the Peckerwoods and see if they had Darla. I had to find an unexpected vantage point, some place they'd be unlikely to notice me. An idea occurred to me. I unsnapped my skis and hid them in the snow beside the garage. The snow was mounded so high that the gutter was in easy reach. I took hold of it, tugging experimentally. It seemed solid. I swung my legs and did a chin-up, trying to clamber onto the roof. Under normal circumstances, it would have been easy, but the wounds on my arm and side hurt, and I was weighed down by my backpack. The gutter bent in my hands, and I heard the screech of a nail starting to pull free. I threw myself onto the roof and released the gutter. It was badly bent. I did my best to straighten it to hide any sign of my passage. I crawled slowly up the icy garage roof. From the peak, the roof of the two-story apartment building was within easy reach. I took hold of the edge and swung myself up. The ridge at the top of the apartment roof would give me perfect cover to scout the maintenance shed. Unless someone looked directly at the roofline, I'd be safe. I fought down my fear and started crawling towards the top. At least it wasn't very steep, even though the ice and snow made it tricky. I poked my head up over the ridgeline. The door of the maintenance shed was open. A group of people were clustered around a roaring fire just inside. I observed for a while, motionless, stomach pressed into the shingles. Three men were working on a truck. It looked like the same pickup I'd seen the bandits driving yesterday. I watched intently, hoping for any sign they might be holding Darla captive. Maybe someone would take food or water to her, and I'd learn where they were keeping her. I was so focused that I lost track of time and was jolted out of my observational trance when my body started shivering. If I waited much longer, I'd freeze to the roof. I low-crawled backward until I was completely hidden from the peckerwoods by the ridgeline. I needed to warm up, but a fire was out of the question, far too dangerous. The apartment roof was too steep to jog on. I scuttled over to a standpipe that jutted from the roof. By clinging to it with my hands, I could safely do leg lifts and side kicks. I worked on those until my leg muscles were burning and my whole body started to warm up. Then I turned around, hooked my ankles around a standpipe, and did push-ups for a while, ignoring the pain of my wounds. By the time I finished, my arms were sore, but I was toasty warm. I slithered back up to the top of the roof and peeked out. Nothing had changed. I stayed on the roof most of the rest of the day, growing more and more uneasy as I watched the peckerwoods. There was no sign of Darla. I tried to get into the apartment building, but there was no way to break in that wouldn't make my presence obvious. Finally, at dusk, they abandoned the garage, trooping back into the apartment building beneath me. I crawled off the roof and stalked across the field between the apartment building and the maintenance shed. The snow here had all been packed down by something. I couldn't see well enough to tell what had done it. Boots, truck tires, or snowmobile tracks, most likely. The surface was slippery, but at least my footprints wouldn't show. When I got closer to the shed, I could see part of the reason the fire looked smaller than it had during the daytime. The big sliding doors were mostly closed. I crept toward the opening. I could faintly hear the crackle of the fire and something else underneath that sound, a low, regular rumbling I couldn't quite identify. It sounded a bit like the purr of a well-tuned engine. I was so close that the heat of the fire warmed my side, but I still couldn't figure out exactly what I was hearing. After about 5 minutes of this, I decided that whatever was making the noise probably wasn't a threat, and leaned sideways to peer into the shed. A snoring man in a filthy orange sleeping bag lay on the far side of the fire, facing directly toward me. Chapter 35. Most of the guy's body was hidden by the sleeping bag, but judging by the way it bulged, he was huge, fat, heavily muscled, or both. His eyes were closed, and he was snoring gently. Why couldn't Darla snore like that instead of her grizzly bear roar? Thinking about Darla brought a wave of sadness so intense I had to bite my lower lip to hold in a sob. I pulled my head back, trying to get my feelings under control. If I found Darla, I'd gladly stay up all night just to listen to her beautiful garbage disposal snore. When I'd calmed down a bit, I thought about the guy by the fire. There had to be a reason he was there. He was guarding something. The snowmobiles and the trucks, maybe. Maybe something else. Maybe Darla. I looked back through the opening. The guard was still snoring rhythmically. I measured the space between the sliding doors with my eyes. I'd fit sideways, but not with my pack on, and I didn't want to go anywhere without my pack. I slipped it off my shoulders and held it out to my side. Slowly, I took a step sideways, sliding my pack through the opening, careful not to touch the metal doors lest they make noise. I stared at the guard, looking for any sign of wakefulness. The fire was so close to the doors, I was almost standing in it when I got inside. I held my pack as high as I could, but my arm was still hot from the flames. If the nylon on my pack melted, the smell alone might wake him. I stepped to the side, pulling my arm and backpack away from the fire. The pickup truck was parked to one side of the fire. On the other side was an open space big enough for another truck. Beyond that, I saw a row of snowmobiles, four intact and one in pieces. I didn't see any sign of the cloth-topped deuce that had carried Darla away from me. I slipped behind the pickup truck, out of sight of the sleeping guard, and crouched to catch my breath. It took a minute for my eyes to adjust to the dim light on the shadowed side of the pickup. When they did, I saw a workbench loaded with tools. Next to it stood a dozen or more tall, cylindrical tanks. Beyond that, in one corner, there was an old minivan resting on blocks. The other corner had been walled off. Corrugated steel formed an interior room of some kind, its metal door directly ahead of me. Judging by the snoring, the guard was still sleeping soundly. I slipped my pack back over my shoulders and slunk toward the door. There were two handles, one affixed to the door and another to the frame. Someone had jammed the broken arm of a large ratchet through both of them, holding the door closed. Why would they bar the door from the outside? To keep someone in? Trembling with excitement, I slipped the ratchet out of the handles. It made a scraping sound that seemed impossibly loud in my ears. I turned to look toward the fire, but the pickup truck blocked my view of the guard, so I couldn't tell if I'd woken him. A creaking noise sounded behind me. I spun back. The door was slowly opening inward of its own accord. I looked inside, half expecting to see Darla in the dim light. But nobody was there. The door was falling open because of some quirk in the building. When it swung fully open, I saw something else hanging from a meat hook, pink and streaked with frozen red-black rivulets. Half of a human rib cage. I let out a short, involuntary yelp. Chapter 36.
"Hey, who's there?"
a voice yelled from the direction of the fire. I stepped inside the abattoir to hide. Bits and pieces of people hung everywhere. The stomach-turning stink of blood that I'd barely noticed as the door opened now overpowered me. I turned my face toward the wall, trying to hide from the room's gruesome contents.
"Guys, it ain't funny to be punkin' brick again."
His voice had a weird sing-song quality, like what I imagined a preschooler might sound like with the vocal cords of a grown man. I slid the glove off my right hand, drew the pistol from my belt, and tried to thumb off the safety. My hands were shaking and slick with sweat. My thumb kept missing the safety, sliding just over the top of it.
"I ain't going to jump and scream like last time, so you can come on out now."
The voice sounded closer. I tucked the pistol under my arm, pulled off my other glove, and used my left hand to snick off the safety.
"I know you're in there."
The voice was very close now.
"You think Brick's a dump truck, but I'm not that dumb. That ratchet didn't fall out on its own."
I held my breath. The guy stepped through the doorway. Half of him was in shadow, the other half lit by firelight. He looked like something an amateur sculptor had attempted to chisel out of an enormous block of granite before giving up the job as hopeless. Then an equally inept painter had come along and covered the sculptor's work with crude blue tattoos of Woody Woodpecker. He turned away from me, checking behind a door. I took one step toward him and jammed my pistol against the back of his head.
"Down! On the floor! Now!"
I used the most commanding tone of voice I could manage while whispering.
"Uh?"
He sounded like a mooing cow.
"Down!"
I repeated. He turned toward me slowly. I pressed the pistol harder against his head, but he kept turning, so that by the time he could look at me, the pistol was against his right temple rather than the back of his head.
"Who are you?"
"Nobody. Now get down, or I'll shoot you."
"Oh, you're a bad guy."
I had to stifle a panicky laugh. I was holding a gun on a cannibal named Brick, standing in a room full of frozen human flesh, and I was the bad guy? On the floor!
"You won't shoot me."
"I will."
"You won't."
"What, do you want me to shoot you?" It was like arguing with a 2-year-old.
"No, but if you shoot, my brothers will hear it."
The apartment building was about 100 yards off. A pistol shot might not wake them, but if they had posted guards... Brick started turning again, slowly reaching for the gun in my right hand. I quickly sidestepped to stay behind him and snapped a front kick toward him. My kick connected perfectly, catching him right between his legs. The hours of farm work, pedaling Bikezilla, and skiing had paid off. My kick was so powerful it lifted him onto his toes. Then he crumpled, collapsing and clutching his crotch. When he could breathe again, he moaned, a sound that started as a low, monotonic, "Ugh," and grew into a high-pitched screech, "Eee!" I quickly shrugged out of my pack and grabbed the first thing that came to hand from the top, a dirty T-shirt. I tied the T-shirt around Brick's head, forcing it between his teeth to muffle him. Then I cut a hank of rope from my coil and used it to tie his hands behind his back. He didn't resist at all, just rocked back and forth on his knees, moaning through the gag. "Get up," I said. He moaned, shaking his head. I moved around to his front and cocked my leg behind me, which was sort of silly. No martial artist would telegraph their moves like that, but I figured it might scare him. "If you don't get up, I'm going to kick you again." He moaned and struggled to his feet. I retrieved my gloves, safetied the pistol, and put my pack back on. "Come on," I said. I led him out of the meat locker into the main part of the shed and shut the door behind us, sliding the broken ratchet back into place. Closing the door on that grisly morgue brought a sigh of relief to my lips. I hoped I'd never have to open it again. Threatening him with further violations to his family jewels, I forced Brick to hide with me behind the dilapidated minivan. Then I made him sit down so I could tie his ankles together. "I'm going to take my T-shirt out of your mouth." I lifted my foot, letting it hover over his groin. "You know what happens if you yell, right?" He nodded. His gaze was affixed on my foot. I knelt beside him and untied the T-shirt. He drooled all over it. I tossed it aside. No way was I going to put that thing back in my pack. "Listen up," I said. "Darla, the girl you caught, is she in there?" I gestured toward the meat locker.
"Girl?"
"Yeah, a little shorter than me, long dark hair, cute." Brick shook his head. "She was shot. She fell on one of your trucks."
"Sky girl?"
"Sky girl?" I repeated, confused.
"She fell out of the sky, whomped on the roof of the cage, made Brick jump."
"Cage?
The truck?"
"Yes, that's right, Sky Girl." I swallowed hard. I didn't want to ask the next question, but I had to know. "Is she alive?"
"I don't know."
"What do you mean you don't know? Was she alive when you found her? Did you kill her?" I balled my fists and lifted my elbow, thinking about smashing his nose.
"She wasn't hurt too bad. Ace said she was a hard belly, hot enough to trade."
"Trade? Where is she?"
"Ace took her, to trade for bullets."
"Took her where? When?"
"To Danny, yesterday."
"Who's Danny? Where did he take her?" I had to stifle the urge to yell.
"He's at the Big Willie, at Grandma's."
"You're not making sense."
"Danny's boss of all the Peckerwoods in Iowa. At the big house in Anamosa, Grandma's.
Ace went to see him yesterday.
And he traded Darla to Danny? At Anamosa?
That's what I just told you. He ain't back yet.
Brick had an expression on his face like he thought I was stupid for even asking.
You gonna eat me?